Welcome to Untangled, a new show from WOSU, where we take a complicated topic and untangle it for you, pull it apart and put the facts together in ways that are easy to understand. This season, we're untangling the housing crisis, from why Gen Z thinks they'll never afford a house, why older millennials and Gen X feel stuck in their starter homes, and why boomers are finding themselves priced out by property taxes. Over the next 6 episodes, we're going to explain how construction costs, zoning, college loans, childcare, and corporate rentals have all raised the cost of a house in Central Ohio beyond what the average buyer can afford. This is Episode 1, The Problem at Home. Housing is the foundation on which our lives are built. From our first neighborhood friends to the schools we attend, housing shapes our access to transportation, fresh fruits and vegetables, exposure to crime, certain health risks. Housing can segregate us or it can integrate. It can help us build wealth or prevent us from saving. Few things influence our futures more than where we live.
Our imagination as we grow up and we think we're going to buy a house and then maybe get a bigger house later on, Now I'm just rethinking all that, going, how did I get that story? Because my parents, they moved around a lot, and they always had a house. But, you know, I don't think the American dream is just way more expensive.
That's David Pardo. He's 55, works at COSI, and lives in Upper Arlington. He bought his 2-bedroom, 1-bath starter house in 2007. Initially, he thought he'd move up, get a bigger house, a bigger yard for his son, but...
You know, I did a little calculation, you know, from what I pay now for a mortgage. If we went with that $450,000 house with the 7.5 interest, that'd be $3,500 a month.
Even when interest rates plummeted during the pandemic, bigger homes in Upper Arlington felt out of reach.
And during the pandemic, we did drive around looking at houses that we thought we could afford in Upper Arlington, but they all needed so much work and they were so expensive. It was just didn't make any sense.
Still, David knows he's lucky to have bought his home when he did.
Yeah, you know, being at COSI, there's a lot of young people, and I've witnessed just recently about probably half a dozen people buying houses, and they're all, you know, in their 30s, and they all start out with one area in mind, and then they've all kind of branched out and gone, you know, the hilltop, and probably not their first choices or even second choices, but they have bought houses in neighborhoods that I wouldn't maybe want to go into. But I guess if you want a house, that's what you have to do.
Here's the thing. All those neighborhoods David's younger colleagues first looked at are affordable. Every neighborhood is affordable. The question we should be asking is affordable for who? And to help answer that, I'm going to bring in Carly Booz. She's the executive director of the Affordable Housing Alliance of Central Ohio and the creator of an amazing slide deck that made me immediately sit up and pay attention. Thanks for joining us, Carly.
Thank you, Anna.
You started that presentation at a housing committee meeting back in August by saying there are 11.7 million definitions of affordable housing, one for every resident of Ohio. But there are general metrics that we use to determine whether housing is affordable, right?
Yeah. And that's exactly where that 11 million number comes from. The scientists, the researchers, the housing creators, everybody says that you should be paying a third of your income towards housing. So Ohio has 11 million people. That means 11 million definitions. But you're also right that that gets a little unwieldy, especially if you're trying to build homes or fund them. So we've created buckets based on different income brackets that lets us make some proxies and some assumptions and kind of create a little bit more definition.
Yeah. And so that number, that's kind of a national number. 30% of your gross income should go to housing and utilities.
And utilities, yes.
So that's your mortgage or your rent, your lights, your water, your gas.
Mm-hmm. And mortgage insurance premiums, insurance for the home, all of that.
So then how many Central Ohioans have affordable housing?
Not nearly enough. One of the ways that we look at it is not just how many people are paying more than they can afford, but how many are paying way more than they can afford. And right now, just in Franklin County, we have 52,000 families who are paying more than half their income towards housing, completely unsustainable at that family level, also at a regional level.
And then do we know about how many people are in that 30 to 50% bracket?
We do. And it's significantly more. You can see up to 80,000 people who are cost burdened, again, just in one county of our region.
Yeah. And I'm sure Delaware County is no better.
No, no. And it's not just Delaware. It's Licking. It's Fairfield. There is nobody in our region who has cracked this code. We are all struggling. They might look different, but these fights are across the borders.
So in Central Ohio, the median income is just shy of $70,000 a year, mm-hmm. which means that a person or a family should be spending about $2,000 a month on rent and utilities. And anybody who's tried to rent an apartment in downtown Columbus knows that might be a pipe dream. But the bigger problem when it comes to home ownership is that the median home price in Central Ohio is $315,000. And the math just doesn't math there.
No. And in fact, if you look at today's rates, because those interest rates are incredibly influential in how much you're going to be paying out of pocket, to buy just the median home today, you're going to be spending $2,700 a month. And many, many, many of our families cannot afford that. We're in this really dangerous place now where the average household can't afford the average home. And that's scary.
Yeah, when I looked at your initial slide deck, you had this number that said it would require an income of $120,000 to qualify for the average house in Ohio now. I mean, Central Ohio, rather.
Yes. Yeah. And again, that's way above where our income ranges actually are. And if you flip it to those households who are most vulnerable, who are working a minimum wage job, even at 40, 50 hours a week, they'd have to work 6 full-time jobs, 10 days a week. It's just not achievable.
Yeah, because there aren't 10 days in a week.
No, there aren't.
So does that constitute a housing crisis to you?
I stay away from the crisis language. We are definitely in a tight spot. The way I think about it, we are standing on a cliff. And we have seen other cities pushed over or jumped over the cliff. But we're in a spot now where we get to make that decision for ourselves. Are we going to pull back from the ledge? Are we going to address our housing needs? Or are we going to go the way of Los Angeles or New York or Austin or Denver? I don't think we're at a crisis yet, but I think we got to figure out if that's where we want to be in 5 years.
And I don't want to oversimplify the issue. I mean, the rest of this series is going to be dedicated to untangling the reasons why. But is a big part of this just simply supply and demand?
It is a big part. We have not been building enough homes for the population that we have for a very long time. Right now, we're only building about one home for every 2.5 jobs that we're creating. So we're falling further and further behind. If you look at other peer communities like Austin, I mentioned earlier, they're building 4 times as many homes as we are. And other peer cities, especially those in the Sun Belt that we're competing against for jobs, they're building 2-3 more times homes as we are. I want to pause quick, though, and say supply and demand all by itself is not going to fix this, because you still need to have the bricks and the sticks, and you need to have the construction workers to come out. There's a minimum cost to building a home, and that minimum is not going to be affordable to workers at the lowest end of our income scale. So we always need to look more expansively than just build more homes, but we need to build more homes, too.
Yeah, and that scarcity, though, that has driven prices up. David, who we heard from at the top of the show, has an interesting indicator for the changes he's seen in his Upper Arlington neighborhood.
In my neighborhood, there's a lot of people who buy and then they're driving up with Lexus or Mercedes or BMW. You know, like they have fancier cars moving into these smaller houses.
Probably because they cost a lot more now.
And I never saw that when we first moved there. So.
Oh, that's really interesting. Because, yeah, the 2-bedroom, 1-bath, that's the starter house.
Yeah. That's... And a lot of those houses where I live, you know, they say 3-bedroom, but one's actually a dining room that's always, like, conversion.
The irony to me is that we're not constructing a lot of those starter houses anymore.
Yeah. And I work downtown. I work at COSI. And all the building that's going on, and I just can't imagine being a young person paying that much money for an apartment.
And I think that's so fascinating because we're talking about construction and we're not building enough houses, but it's also the kinds of houses that we're building. You don't often hear about 1,000-square-foot homes getting built in Central Ohio.
No, and in fact, Fannie Mae, a giant in the housing finance world, has tracked how many starter homes we're building each decade. And in the 70s, when we had a fraction of the population, we were doing significantly more construction in that starter home range. Today, we're building about 70,000 homes for that kind of entry-level buyer. In the past, it's been 300,000 or 400,000. So we're way off our historical marks.
And in that infamous or famous slide deck of yours, I really loved it. You had this statistic that the greater Columbus area has lost 47,000 affordable rental homes in the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm. So there are 47,000 homes that used to rent for $900 a month, and they just don't anymore. And I think as folks are driving up and down the street, you're not seeing construction crews tearing down homes. This isn't demolition. This isn't loss. It's that those rents are going up and up and up. And to tie that back to David's story, the more you pay on rent as a younger person, someone just entering the workforce, the less you're saving for a down payment and the further and further away home ownership starts to feel.
Yeah. And, you know, when it comes to those downtown condos that he referenced, it might be easy for some folks to dismiss the desire to live in downtown in a condo as a luxury, an extension of the avocado toast argument that you hear when younger people complain about their financial struggles. But it is sort of a question if you want that lifestyle, if you don't want to drive, if you want to be close to groceries, work, bars, restaurants, galleries, movies, it's a premium.
Mm-hmm. It is. And I think work is exactly the one that I would call out first and foremost. It is not a luxury to be within 20 minutes or 30 minutes or even an hour of where you go to work. There was just a study that came up from Boston, which isn't exactly identical to Columbus, but there's some parallels there that are really interesting. The average Boston family spends 130 hours in traffic just getting to work and back. That's kids' baseball games, that's a hobby, that's an ability to put more hours into whatever it is that you find amusing. That's not a luxury. That's about how we spend time with our families and how we prioritize our lives. And right now, we don't have housing that is near where we are creating jobs.
And we keep building out and out and out and out, right? Delaware County used to be, you know, a good mix of agricultural and suburban. They suspect that by 2050, the population of that county will have doubled.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all, maybe it's hyperbole to say all, but it's predominantly single family, larger homes at about 2,000 square feet.
Absolutely. And if you go back to that statistic you mentioned, that we have lost those 47,000 homes that used to be less than $900 a month, we're seeing almost identical gains in the range of $1,200 per month. So the rent isn't going up just a little bit, it's going up a lot of it. And for context, that's the equivalent of losing every home in Hilliard, every home in Reynoldsburg, and every home in Westerville in terms of an affordability loss. It is just a giant number.
Yeah, and I think this is a good time to ask you a more broader 30,000-foot view question, because I think what we're talking about here to a large extent is how we define a good life, a middle-class life. For me, it means a working family that can afford a house, probably has two cars, not new cars, but reliable vehicles. They can take a vacation once a year, have a bit of a savings for emergency. I think that's what we're talking about, right? That kind of stability.
Yeah, and I think for a lot of families, it's even more modest than that, right? It's just, can I get to where I'm going? I don't necessarily need two cars, but maybe I can have one car and easy access to a bus stop. Yeah, and I think there's something really special about the fact that that American dream definition is so universal on one hand. We are all shooting for that life, but it's also incredibly individualistic, and we all have different interpretations of what that means, and that's such a great reflection of what housing should be. We all need it. It's universal, but it can look different for everybody, and it should.
Yeah, because not everybody wants the 2,500-square-foot, half-an-acre suburban house.
No, and a lot of younger generations don't. And this is on par with different trends that we've seen in consumer spaces for Gen Z and millennials overall. Much more emphasis on experiences, on being able to go out, to be able to take in a show, to go on a vacation. Less emphasis on consumer goods, like a big house and all of the things that you would put in it. So you're hearing a lot of frustration from folks who are working with real estate agents and saying, look, I don't want the 25,000 square foot home with the $2.5 million mortgage, even if I can afford it. That's not the thing that I want.
And yet the average square footage of a home keeps going up and up and up. And I keep wondering, who are they building these for?
Well, there is a need there. They are going off the market really quickly. There are consumers there who want to buy at that price point. But you got to think about it in terms of the systemic influences that are shaping what is built and where. And it is very, very difficult for a builder to try and construct a home right now, let alone an entire development or complex of homes. So if I'm artificially hindered from building so many homes, and they say, instead of the 100 homes that you'd really like to build this year, I'm only going to let you build 10. What would you do naturally? You're going to build 10 expensive ones instead of 100 inexpensive ones. That's a systemic reaction to zoning laws and land use laws and a lot of the bureaucracy that shapes how our built environment is constructed.
And for those who want to know more about that, I should tell you that episode 2 is all about zoning and construction costs and what we can do to bring those down, because there are minimum square footage requirements. There are minimum distances between houses. There are minimum lot sizes. And all of this contributes to the cost of a house.
Mm-hmm.
And I also want to ask for your feedback. If you can't keep up with your rent increases, or you feel like you're never going to buy a house, maybe you snagged a low interest rate now and you're stuck in your starter home, or you're getting priced out by your property taxes. If you have a housing story you'd like to share with us as we untangle this issue, email allsides@wosu.org. So, Carly, any final thoughts or important takeaways as we begin this process of untangling the housing crisis?
Yeah, it's not inevitable. We don't have to live in a housing crisis. We're not marching towards something that can't be reversed. We just did a research study, first of its kind in the country, as far as we can tell, that shows all of the different benefits that the region can gain by solving its housing challenges. And it's across the board. We would be able to put 3,000 more third graders into a position where they're able to read. They're reading proficient. Incredibly important milestone, because that dictates whether you're going to be successful in high school and in college and in the workforce. We could create 40,000 jobs just by investing in our housing, not only construction jobs, those straight blue-collar jobs that have always been so reliable, but also that secondary economic benefit that comes with it. And our health would benefit as well. We would be able to extend our life expectancy by more than 5 years just by meeting that deficit of our housing needs. So whether it's health, whether it's jobs in the workforce, or whether it's our kids' education, housing is the vehicle that gets us to the place that we want to be overall.
That was Carly Booz, Executive Director of the Affordable Housing Alliance of Central Ohio. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, a local realtor is going to explain the Central Ohio market. That's when All Sides Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Untangled, where we take complicated topics and untangle them for you. This season, we're untangling the housing crisis. Zillow predicted that Columbus metro area would be one of the hottest housing markets in 2024. Here to help us understand that market is Mick Gordon, a real estate consultant with Keller Williams Greater Columbus. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you, Anna. Thanks for having me this morning.
Can you start by telling us what the market is like for first-time homebuyers here in Central Ohio?
I sure can. It's tough right now. The market is very thin when it comes to inventory, and most of that gap is at the first-time homebuyer market level price range. And the stuff that does come on the market tends to move pretty quickly, and a lot of times for over list price, which is causing a lot of first-time homebuyers not to be able to participate.
Are you seeing multiple bids, cash above appraisal? Is it, like, how crazy is it?
It's starting to get crazy again. Everything's settled down for almost 6 months. The interest rates rising sort of slowed things down, tapped the brakes on the market. But now that the weather's starting to break and we're heading back into our selling season, you know, the good listings that come on the market are going quickly and for top dollar.
And what if somebody wants a true starter house, say something less than 1,400, even 1,200 square feet? How challenging it is to find that kind of house?
It is. It's very challenging, to answer your question. And what we're seeing with a lot of first-time home buyers in this market, they might not be able to buy a first-time house, their first home, in the area that they grew up in. And they might have to move out farther outside of the city where the prices aren't quite as high as they are in, say, a Westerville, Worthington, a suburb, or even the city of Columbus.
Is that because a lot of those small starter homes are older homes in perhaps Clintonville, Upper Arlington, Bexley? Like, they're in these small starter homes seem to be in these very established, very expensive areas.
Yeah, you could say that, you know, and also, you know, the builders out in the world right now are not building 1,400 square foot homes. They're building 2,400 square foot homes and larger.
What about the move-up buyer, the folks who already own a home, and maybe they've outgrown it, but they have that 2-3% interest rate?
Yeah, that's a tough one. You know, you combine the pandemic, rising interest rates, you know, everything that's happened over the last 4 years, we're really in unknown area, charted waters, uncharted waters, because of that. And, you know, the fact of the matter is those same people know that maybe their life changed a little bit because they now have outgrown the home. You know, they've also enjoyed the last 4 years worth of appreciation. So they have a lot of cash to put back into the market once they do sell that home, which can, you know, counteract a higher interest rate. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, if you need a bigger home, you need a bigger home.
I want to bring David back into this conversation. He's the 55-year-old homeowner from Upper Arlington who says his starter house became his forever home.
My 18-year-old, the whole reason why we came to Upper Arlington is get him through school. You know, he's going to graduate, and now we're going to have an extra room. So now it does it. It's like, okay, well, we can survive this small house now with two people. So I don't know if we'll actually move until we actually retire, if we do.
And one of the big reasons David says he's staying put is that interest rate. He actually estimated what it would cost him to take out a mortgage at today's rate on what he has left on his current loan, and his monthly payment would go up by $500. So he's basically like, we survived raising a kid in 1,000 square feet. It's going to be a lot easier now that he's going to college.
Well, this hits me right where I live. I'm a 55-year-old man with two daughters. One just graduated from Ohio State.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. One is graduating from Ohio State in the spring. And it's part of our conversation. We live in the northeast side of town, and Intel's coming in. And I've got a sub 3% interest rate on my mortgage. So I know I'm living that life. And I'm not sure we're going to move. And I think we're going to be battling this for a while. You know, I don't think we'll ever see interest rates in the 2s and 3%. I think we're going to be really lucky if we see it in the 4s again. But the fact of the matter is, life goes on, and, you know, good for him. He's able to stay in that home. He's actually being able to expand his footprint because he doesn't have the kids at home anymore, right? That house probably seems huge now.
Yeah, I ran the numbers, and they're stunning. So a $315,000 house, average house in Central Ohio. Let's say you're putting 5% down. When the interest rate was 3%, you could swing that on $75,000 a year. Now that the interest rates are closer to 7, you need more than $100,000 a year. Same house, same price. And, you know, I understand those numbers, and yet somehow I don't understand those numbers. Can you make it make sense?
Sure. You have to look back historically, Anna. You know, what we saw for the last almost 10 years was an anomaly historically. The average 30-year fixed interest rate, since they've been tracking this going back into the 60s and 70s, is almost 8%, right? And that's including the last 10 years of, you know, sub 4 and sub 3 interest rates. So, my wife and I bought our first house at 9.5%. So, you know, I think we're getting back to what used to be normal. And I think we got to enjoy a very long period of low interest rates coming out of the Great Recession, you know, so on and so forth. So I think we're moving back to a little bit of a new norm, which is an old norm, right? Interest rates in the sevens, interest rates in the sixes. And it's just going to be different.
Yeah. The challenge, though, is, because I also did the math on this, in 1980, the average cost of a house was $47,000. And the average person earned about 12 grand. This is a lot of numbers. I apologize. I know it's radio. But so today, that house, though, that $47,000 house, that average house in 1980, is about $400,000. But we only earn, on average, about $56,000. So it is a ton of numbers. But the important takeaway is that home prices have gone up 10 times, while salaries have gone up less than half that. So basically, that bigger interest rate in 1980 was actually more affordable than it is today because of the home prices. Does that make sense?
It does. And affordability is the key phrase there. And it's the one thing as realtors, people in the real estate industry continue to watch. It's things that Zillow, Realtor.com, Homes.com all judge in best places to live, right? Because home affordability is a big factor that comes into that. And Columbus, Ohio is still significantly more affordable than some of our counterparts, same city, like cities like Nashville, Austin, even Indianapolis, so close to home. Columbus is still great value.
Carly, who we spoke to earlier, described it as we're walking up to the edge of a cliff. So she said, we're not Austin. We're not Denver, Los Angeles, some of these places with real affordability crises. But she's like, we're walking there. We're going to get to that cliff. Do you worry about that? Like, do you worry that your kids will be able to afford houses in Central Ohio?
Sure I do. And that goes back to real estate being probably one of the most sound investments in our lifetimes, in our country, and in our economy. And, you know, real estate equity, you just described it. That house at $47,000 in 1980 is now worth $400,000. Well, you know, that's the growth in equity that those people get to enjoy. And they're probably closer to retirement and able to add to their nest egg. But yeah, the real estate industry in Ohio and in the United States, quite frankly, is sort of at a perfect storm of coming off a pandemic, coming off of 10 years worth of low interest rates, which we needed to get out of the Great Recession of 2008 through 2012. It is a concern, and it's something that I watch all the time, especially with 24 and 22-year-old daughters.
But houses aren't too expensive everywhere in Ohio. So Columbus's median home price is more than $300,000. But in Lima, Ohio, it's $125,000. So there are affordable houses. It's just a question of where you want to live.
Yeah, that's true. And that goes back to one of your earliest questions for me. You know, those first-time homebuyers, they might have to drive a little further than they hoped to be able to get into that lower price inventory, to be able to start the American dream of home ownership and building equity over their lifetime.
Do you also see not enough new home construction? There seems to be a concern that here, at least in Central Ohio, we need to be building many, many, many more houses than we are at the current rate.
Yeah, Anna, the last I heard from the BIA of Central Ohio is for us to play some sort of catch up, we need to build 18,000 residential units, and that includes for sale product as well as apartments and for rent. And this year, which will be our best year in 20, we expect to do 14,000. So that gap continues. And boy, we could talk for an hour on this one, but you know, you've got municipalities and you've got people in those municipalities that don't want development, that don't want, you know, a subdivision across the street that used to be this amazing, gorgeous farm, right? That maybe that farmer's ready to sell out and sell to a developer and retire. But that's a big thing. And it's something that whether I'm at City Hall here in Columbus or I'm at the State House or a couple of weeks ago was in Washington, D.C. at the Capitol, it's the conversation we're having. We're explanatory. It's I'll give you an idea. When we go visit the Hill in Washington, we usually have 3 or 4 talking points around real estate. This time we had 10, and all 10 were focused on inventory and little by little how we get out of the issue that we have here. It's not going to take one thing. It's going to probably take 10 or more things to be able to ease out of this, and it's going to take time.
Yeah, I always say if you want to experience like real local angry, like shouting, screaming politics, go to a planning commission meeting where there's a housing development being proposed.
Yes. And you know what? We're starting to see more and more realtors show up to that and to advocate on behalf of some of these developers. Because the fact of the matter is, yes, Columbus, Ohio has been great. You get out into some of the outskirts of the suburbs and they're used to seeing all this farmland. But the fact of the matter is, you know, we just landed a $20 billion investment from Intel, and these jobs continue to come into Central Ohio, and those jobs have to go somewhere to live. We need to have it.
When I talked with David, he said he bought his house back in 2007 with zero money down. Now, there were a lot of exotic home loans that probably weren't a good idea, probably led to the Great Recession, but this one worked out for him. And as home prices rise and continue to rise, I think saving for that down payment is a real stumbling block, especially for a lot of younger Ohioans.
It is. We have been advocating for 5 years at Ohio Realtors at the State House to create a home buyer savings program that would be very similar to a 529 for college that is tax exempt at the state level. We did get that passed in last year's budget. So we're trying to work all the angles that we can to make it. And it's not just something that the future homeowner can put in that savings account. Their parents can do it. Their grandparents can help them with it. And I think it's going to take a lot of us to get these younger first-time homebuyers, whether they're young or not, it doesn't matter their age, right, to be able to get over the hump and to have the amount of down payment it takes.
That's kind of a crazy thought. Save for your child's college. Save for your child's future house. Like, make contributions to both as they're growing up.
Yeah.
That was Mick Gordon, a real estate consultant with Keller Williams Greater Columbus Realty. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Anna. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we're expanding our conversation from Columbus to the country at large. That's when Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Untangled, where we take a complicated topic and untangle it for you. This season, we're untangling the housing crisis. And now I want to expand our conversation beyond our own backyards. Home prices have skyrocketed in Central Ohio, but Columbus isn't Denver, and it's certainly not San Francisco, where the average home price is more than $1 million. It seems impossible to think that Columbus prices could ever reach that high. But 10 years ago, paying $500,000 for a fixer-upper in Clintonville would have sounded just as crazy. Here to help us untangle home prices across the country is Luis Eduardo Quintero, an economist from Johns Hopkins University who studies cities and real estate. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Anna.
Let's start with the big picture. How would you describe the housing market in the United States?
I would describe it as a very big housing crisis, an affordability problem that has been going on for decades now. So it's not a short-term crisis. It's not something that will go away. It's something that is structural.
And I don't want to oversimplify the causes. We're actually going to spend the next 5 episodes exploring those. But can the issue be reduced, at least in part, to something as simple as supply hasn't caught up with demand.
Yes, that is a very good way of putting it. And now, like you're saying, there's many reasons behind what demand dynamics that we have been seeing in the last years, and also a lot of reasons of explaining why supply hasn't adapted. But in the end, that is the problem. In the end, is all the obstacles, either legal in terms of market dynamics, in terms of costs, technology, that are preventing supply from really satisfying what has been a very, you know, long-term increasing demand for housing.
When it comes to cities in particular, what do you think are some of the biggest barriers that gets in the way of building more units?
One of the things that is very, you know, one of the main barriers in the United States is the way we organize regulation and the authorization for new construction. This is something that we take for granted here, but this is not the way new construction and, you know, new housing regulation is handled elsewhere in the world. Normally you have either state or city authorities and metropolitan area authorities making the decisions and weighing the costs and benefits of everyone involved in a whole housing market or metropolitan area. In the United States, we have an over decentralization of these types of decisions. So we have small zoning boards that basically account to the level of a neighborhood. And so these are neighborhoods, and you're probably familiar with the term NIMBYism, not in my backyard. So these are small neighborhoods making decisions that affect not only the metropolitan area, but basically affect the whole country in terms of like preventing people from being able to move into an area where they have economic opportunities. And they are making the decisions based on their own self-interest, mainly to preserve home values.
And we're going to dive in next week to construction costs, NIMBYism, and zoning. But I was hoping that you could explain something that you've looked at that I find particularly interesting. Can you explain what happens when there is a consolidation among home builders?
Yes. So that is another interesting factor that adds to this complicated problem. So all of it boils down, as we said before, to supply not reacting and growing enough. And so in general, if you think about any type of market, we worry about consolidation and concentration in a few suppliers, because when a single supplier of a good or service has monopolistic power, they can just control prices, right? And so they can take advantage of a growth in demand by just increasing prices and withholding supply. Now, in a market, what we expect is other competitors to come in and offer the same good or service at a lower price, therefore curbing the possibility of that initial incumbent supplier to, you know, charge whatever price they want. When there is consolidation and you have strong market power, what you're seeing is the prevention of those market dynamics from, you know, putting a stop to the abilities of, you know, the surviving developers to charge whatever they want. This is something that I've been studying. And what I see is that it started, I mean, this has always been a concentrated market, but this became especially difficult and, big after the housing market crisis in the Great Recession in 2008. So a lot of developers went out of business. They went bankrupt. And it was much more difficult for smaller developers to stay afloat in such a big crisis. And as a consequence, it was the bigger developers that stayed alive. And overnight, almost, went from producing 20, 30, 35% of the units in a market, depending on how you, you know, which market you're considering, to in some cases producing 60, 70, 75 to 80% of all the new units. So all of a sudden they control the market. And that is something that you would expect usually in a crisis. What is puzzling and difficult now is that house prices have completely recovered. since 2011, we've seen a complete recovery of the housing prices to these days. And we still have not seen a recovery in the number of builders present in the market, right? So on one end, we expect people to go out of business in a recession. And then when the market picks up and prices go up again, that provides incentives for new builders to come in. We haven't seen that in the housing market, right? The crash kicked out a lot of the developers, and we are still around 60% down from the times of the Great Recession in terms of number of builders active in the market.
How many homes nationally do you think this consolidation has cost us?
That's a difficult number to guess. So in general, my best estimates say that nationally, this would be something like 4 to 6% decline in annual homes produced relative to what would happen if we had a market that was as competitive as what we had in 2006. And again, this means this is, you know, a big average. And what that means is, like, in some places this could respond to a difference of only 1%, and in other places maybe 10-15%. That's the other thing about housing, right? And you mentioned San Francisco and LA at the beginning of our talk. Housing, you know, housing markets are very spatially different. So the same happens with consolidation, right? We're talking about something that has been happening nationwide, but in some places it's been particularly strong.
Right, because you can't ship a house across the country the way you can ship a pair of pants. So there can't be some amazing home builder in California who is constructing houses for Central Ohio.
That is exactly right. And that is one of the reasons why I, in my work, have questioned why judicial authorities like, you know, the FTC and the Department of Justice have allowed big mergers between the largest developers in the country. And some of the reasons they give is, well, there we have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of home builders. And my point is exactly yours, which is, it doesn't matter if you have 100 builders in Miami, you know, that is not a threat. You know, having low prices for homes in Miami is not a threat for somebody producing a home in Seattle. Those are not two things that are substitutes for you as a homeowner. You're deciding, you know, maybe between a couple of neighborhoods, maybe between two cities, but you're not really thinking about moving all the way to the other side of the country because of slightly lower home prices.
Yeah, because buying a house is so much about buying a place where you want to live. And some people will move. They will move across the country for more affordable housing. But that's not the vast majority of us.
And in fact, that is a good thing, right? We want people to be able to move to follow economic opportunities. And it's not a coincidence that we are at a record, historically record high in terms of the problem of housing unaffordability. Right, you will usually measure that as the share of housing costs that a household would have to spend on housing every month compared to their income. And we're at an all-time high, basically. It's been going up for decades. And we're also at an all-time low in terms of mobility across places, right? So the new economy has changed significantly. And so the sectors that were profitable for people to work in usually focus around industry, you know, manufactured goods, has moved to an information economy. And so the places that are producing this information economy have also changed. And so normally what you would see is that with an economic change, you see a movement of the population. And in this case, the movement of the population have been slowed down because the places where most economic opportunity happens are too expensive for people to move to.
We started our show this hour with David Pardo, a Gen Xer from Upper Arlington who bought what he thought would be his starter house back in 2007. And I asked him whether he worries about whether his son, who's going off to college, is going to buy a house. Do you worry about your, you said it's your son, right?
Yes.
Do you worry at all about whether he'll be able to buy a house when he gets older?
Oh, yeah. He won't be buying in Upper Arlington. Well, he might. It depends how well he does in college. But I mean, that's the mystery is like, what are all these people doing to make money to afford these new houses and stuff? Like, did I pick the wrong career path? I mean, I'm joking about that, but it does cross my mind. I'm like, what do these people do?
I think that question hits on this feeling that many people have, particularly younger folks, like younger millennials, Gen Z, when they see their friends or acquaintances buy houses who they thought had similar finances to their own. And then they're looking at them like, how did you afford that? Go ahead.
It is true. You know, it is. One drives around and thinks, well, what do these people do that they get to live here? But, you know, it is a very valid concern because we are seeing, again, if you look at it in the long run, we're seeing fewer and fewer young people being able to afford homes. And this extends to the rental market, right? An additional concern is being able to rent a home, which was usually something that, you know, younger people would do while they were able to afford buying one. And so both markets have been, you know, depleted out of units relative to the growth in demand and the growth in population. And so it is a very valid concern whether, you know, this is going to be an even bigger problem. And as I was saying, I always like to connect this to economic activity, right? On one end, we, of course, understand how important it is to be able to afford a home. But this goes beyond just being able to have a nice place. This goes to, you know, the ability of workers to actually live in the place that they work. And so we see in many places where lower income workers in some of these very expensive cities, we call them superstar cities, right, in the profession, but they are superstar in terms of economic productivity. They're not very good at providing a way of life that is comfortable and reasonable in terms of commuting times, for example, for those that are providing maybe the, you know, middle to lower income jobs.
And that filters out into the rest of the market, because if you're paying 30, 40, 50% of your income on rent or a mortgage, then you're not going out to eat as much. You're not getting your hair or your nails done as much. Your kids probably aren't in as many sports activities. You're taking fewer vacations. A lot gets sacrificed for that housing.
And this is something that changes over time, right? So we are very familiar with the pandemic and what happened with this, you know, quote unquote, superstar cities. And we saw it in New York City. We saw it in San Francisco, people moving out because, you know, the economy was bad. And then they realized, why would I stay here paying for such a, you know, expensive rent or mortgage when I am working remotely, right? And so it is difficult to forecast what's going to happen. There's been a lot of research done on whether cities will go back to working most of, you know, having most of the work done in the office, or that, you know, whether remote work will be the norm. I think it's a combination, and that definitely affects prices. People moving out of cities and companies releasing some office space in downtown areas has given a little bit of a break to home prices and rents, not meaning that they are going down, meaning that they, you know, stopped accelerating as fast as they were before. And we don't know what's going to happen in the future, right? But if we actually want to have thriving cities where people want to live in, then we need to do something about housing.
That was Luis Eduardo Quintero, an economist from Johns Hopkins University who studies city and real estate. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
And that's going to do it for this very first episode of Untangled. Next week, we're deep diving into zoning and how the rules for what we build contribute to the costs. Thanks for listening to Untangled, a production of WOSU and All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.